This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
I would like to welcome two-time PGA Tour winner Donnie Hammond to the Sub 70 podcast. Donnie, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Jason, nice to be with you this morning.
Well, I know you're up at the Champions Tour event at the Ally at Warwick Hills up in Michigan. How's your game feeling at this point? How's the practice sessions going? And how are you looking to get into the tournament at this point from that standpoint of where your position is?
Well, I was an alternate early in the week, so I'm still right around 10th alternate. It doesn't look good that I'll get in this tournament. And I'm kind of practicing right now to try to get ready for next week's tournament in South Dakota. It's another first-time event on the Champions Tour, and it should be pretty cool up there. I've never been to the Dakotas, so it might be a fun trip.
The golf game, how's it progressing? Anything you're working on in particular? You know, sort of where's your overall assessment of where you're at right now?
Well, I'm working on all kinds of things right now. I just got in a tournament a couple weeks ago up in Calgary, didn't play well. But I did get a chance to figure out what I need to work on, which is everything, especially kind of the nerves, getting out there and playing in front of a bunch of people, you know, hitting a lot of demanding shots with hybrids over water, you know, strategy, a lot of the parts of the game that you lose when you haven't played in a few years. So luckily I putted well. The short game was pretty good. So I think it's getting out, getting in some tournaments and just, you know, having a few good rounds and get back to remembering what you used to do, you know, for 20 or 25 years.
Yeah. And so, and with all the experience that you've had, you know, you played almost 500 PGA Tour events. Does it take a little bit still to come back? I've heard people on the podcast talking about like the rhythm of a professional tournament round is just different. And it, even though you've played in a bunch of events, it still takes a little time to get that rhythm back. Is that sort of a fair assessment of difference between, you know, high-level tournament golf versus even playing a competitive game at home?
Yeah, and it's taken, you know, I kind of got into the business world there for about 4 years after the qualifyings on the Champions Tour went to only two spots. I kind of, there wasn't a big future in that, you know, to play for 2 or 3 years when there were only two spots to play for. Kind of got in the automotive business with a friend, and you know, to be honest, it's taken a good solid year and a half to get back to where you even feel competitive. And then you have to take the jump from, you know, thinking that you're competitive to going out and trying to play against Jerry Kelly and Bernhard Langer and Kirk Triplett, who, you know, have been playing well for 30 years. So that's the next step, is to be able to get out there and be equal with those guys and to be able to compete week to week. And that'll be the next step.
I also know back in Florida you've been doing some teaching as well. How much have you enjoyed that portion of sharing your knowledge and passing it on to your students? And is there a certain aspect of the teaching that you focus on, or do you look at all the parts of a student's game and see how you can make them better?
Yeah, I'm not a one-method teacher. I like to work with kids, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-olds that are, you know, they're really coachable, and they – you know, they can improve pretty quick. They can do the things with their arms and their shoulders and their hands that it's harder for someone that's 50 or 60 years old to be able to do. And that's enjoyable, because you can see the progression of their game and the improvement fairly quickly. And, you know, they're usually motivated. And so we work on different things. I like to take kids and, you know, even adults out on the golf course and play 6 or 8 holes and be able to work on all parts of the game, like course management, club selection, you know, little tricks around the greens that we've learned to save strokes, because that's where you can really get your handicap down, is with the short game. So that's the part that we work on probably half as much. And yeah, it's gone pretty good. I've enjoyed it so far the last few years that I've been teaching.
I've always wondered, if you start teaching, but you played and accomplished, you know, what you did on the PGA Tour, is it hard at times to teach, to have to know that the students, 99.99% of them, are not going to have your talent to be able to to do what you still see or how you see a shot? Is it hard not to have that same expectation that you've had for yourself? I guess is what I'm asking, when you're kind of teaching it down at a level.
Well, yeah, you do look at students and you look at kind of their potential, whether you think they could be, you know, a really good college player, maybe a pro. And everyone's in the game for different reasons too. When you start teaching a beginner or, you know, someone that's 50 years old and wants to go from an 8 handicap down to a 4, you know, they're pretty sure they're not going to go out and try to play the Champions Tour, you know, in the next few years. You know, they have their goals and what they want to accomplish with the game. So usually those ones that are, you know, the kids that are 14 to 17, those are the ones you kind of look at and you kind of think to yourself, which ones do have, you know, the hand-eye coordination or the motivation and the mindset to be able to make it to that next level. And it's exciting when you see some kids. They're so much better now than we used to be. You know, when we were 15 or 17 years old, the kids are shooting, you know, they shoot par, under par, before they even hit college now. So a lot more talented, a lot better coaching early, and just really good athletes, too.
You think the equipment made a difference with that as well? Or it does make a difference?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're 14 and you can set a 460cc driver down there and be able to make pretty good contact and make, you know, to be able to hit it anywhere near the sweet spot, it's going to get out there a couple hundred yards. Drivers I started with, those persimmon, you had to, I mean, that sweet spot was, you know, a tenth the size of a dime. So you had to catch it right on in the center of that fiber insert. You catch it in the heel and it's going to go 220, 230 yards out there. So it was a lot tougher. And now, you know, it makes it easier. The kids have clubs that are more built for their age, and they take advantage of it. So I think that helps.
Another Champions Tour question I had when I was doing sort of my research for this podcast is, I'm assuming with your tour, when you turned 50, with the two wins that you had, were you fully exempt at that point? And how long does that exemption last when you've won twice on the PGA Tour with as many starts as you've had?
Yeah, it's kind of still similar. In the last 10 years, when I did turn 50, I had two wins, maybe $4.5 million official on the PGA Tour. But when I was 50 and 51 for those 2 years, I was exempt for about 75% of the tournaments. So I got in maybe 14 or 15 the first 2 years on tour, made about $150,000 each year. But that wasn't enough to qualify me on that current year's money list to go forward. So when I turned 52, I came out of that category with wins, and then I had to go to the qualifying. So now they've changed the exemption a little bit. Guys with 13 million official, there's 10 spots on the money list now that on the eligibility list that can play every week. And it's the base on that is about 13 million. So it's changed a little bit, but they still have that category. Darren Clark is actually playing in that wins category, and he'll play in that until he turns 52.
So you usually get a couple years to sort of get out there, and then at that point when you're done with those first 2 years, you have to basically kind of go off where you're performing on the money list.
Yeah, you would have to be roughly in the top 45 on the money list or have at least 13 million official on the money list.
So how did you start playing golf? Who got you interested in the game, and how did your progression go from starting off to sort of, you know, thinking, hey, I can do this for a living?
Yeah, like most kids, you know, I started out with my dad, and my mom and dad would take me to the golf course, but I would play with my dad. We would go growing up in Frederick, Maryland, just outside of Baltimore and Washington. We would go to this little 9-hole course, Westminster, and we'd play 9 holes, and then we'd go watch the Baltimore Colts practice right when I started playing. That's when you could get right on the pretty much the field with the guys. And Don Shula was the coach, Johnny Unitas, Ray Berry, Bubba Smith. We'd kind of hang out with the players a little bit after practice. And then that became fun for a month or so. And, you know, I kind of had a pretty good handle on golf right away. I kind of picked it up fairly quick. I was playing baseball and football, and, you know, as normal human experience. When you're, you know, you get good at something, you kind of tend to enjoy it a little more. So I kind of gravitated toward golf that summer, and then had some friends that were playing at the local club. And then we just started playing, you know, whenever we had a chance, after school, weekends, you know, drop us off at 8 a.m. and come back and get us at 5 that night. So we got to, you know, get pretty good fairly quickly there that summer.
And then when did college start to look like a reality that you're going to be able to play golf in college, and then the process of saying, I'm going to go to the next level and turn professional? How did that progress sort of come about?
Yeah, a couple big things happened in college. After my second year, I went in to meet our coach to let him know I was going to flight school at Embry-Riddle. I wanted to be a commercial pilot. And within about a half hour, Coach Rourke talked me into staying at Jacksonville University and putting this notion in my head that maybe I could get on the PGA Tour, buy an airplane, and then fly, you know, have the love of flying and be on the tour like Arnold Palmer.
Right.
Like, yeah, but I don't think I'm going to be as good as Arnold Palmer. So buy a smaller plane. So I left the office and I thought, wow, I think that probably was something big that just happened that I'm probably going to look back and it's going to be a defining part. And it, you know, and it ended up working out pretty good for me like that, that I got to get my pilot's license and have a plane and fly for 10 years on the tour. But the third year of college, I was kind of staring at thinking, you know, if the golf doesn't work out, I got to figure out what I'm going to do for a living. And then suddenly I started golfing better after that, kind of staring at a job or, you know, employment for the next 30 or 40 years. So that's when kind of the adrenaline started kicking in and I started playing better and kind of dedicating myself a little bit to making a profession out of golf.
And then you turned pro in 79, and I think back then they had two Q schools a year. Did you go to Q school right away? Did you play mini tours? How was your pathway then to getting on to the PGA Tour?
Yeah, I went to Orlando. That's where the J.C. Goosey Tour was. And, you know, I played there. I think I skipped the first semi-annual tour school, and then I missed a couple Q schools, missed qualifying, played really well the third year on the mini tour. I was winning a lot of tournaments and I won the Florida Open that summer. And then I went to the Q school in Jacksonville and ended up making it there. I ended up winning the tour school that year in 82 and then managed to kind of stay on tour there for 10 or 15 years after that.
That's like legendary of what you did in 82 to win Q school by 14 shots. Like, what kind of zone were you in that week? Because that's like supposed to be the most nervous grind ever, the hardest, you know, it's like a major if you win that one in a lot of guys' eyes in the sense of like the pressure that's there. How in the hell do you win that thing by 14? That's crazy good.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about getting into the zone. I kind of developed something with my setup, with my right knee was kind of tucked in, and I had my left knee out just a little bit. And I came up with that the night before the first round. So I was kind of locked in, where you know how Gary Player kind of starts his backswing by pushing the right knee in a little bit,
kickstarter,
you know, to release the pressure. I started with it firm like that, and I had my left knee out a little bit. So all I had to do was just take my shoulders back, and my legs didn't really move. So I kind of, you know, rode that for the whole week and had some good breaks, putted well, and, you know, didn't really have any disasters out there, which you could have it, you know, playing TPC and Sawgrass, two really tough courses. So, you know, a combination of luck and just being locked in with that setup, and kind of took it out on tour for about 8 weeks and was on the range at LA talking to Ed Fiore. He said, how the hell did you shoot the scores you did at TPC? I said, here, I'll show you my setup. Kind of get my leg locked this way, left leg locked. Like, I said, how's it look, Ed? He said, doesn't look well, but I'd keep doing it. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's a record that still stands. Like you said, usually that's somebody has a bad round in there, the nerves start getting to them. Just to be that locked in for that period that's crazy good. And in 86, you win on the PGA Tour at the Bob Hope. You beat John Cook in a playoff. When you finally get to that apex, right, you've climbed the mountain. and you've been playing the tour for a while at that point. Is it elation or relief or a combo of both?
Yeah, it wasn't as much relief because I didn't really expect, you know, to be able to one thing, maybe even get out on tour. That was kind of a surprise to, you know, go from being a junior golfer, college golfer, and then being able to get out there on tour, hitting balls next to Jack Nicklaus. So it was just a thrill that, you know, that I figured I really accomplished something. And, you know, dream come true when you're a kid. You want to try to win a tournament on the PGA Tour. Maybe the U.S. Open. Maybe you're thinking this putt's to win the Masters, but at least to win a tournament on tour. So that was just a great, great feeling and accomplishment. And, you know, right away, I realized that I was going to be able to go play Augusta that year. And that took about 5 seconds after the putt on the first playoff hole went in. So really exciting.
Well, let's talk about the 86 Masters. You were in there and you finished T11 that year. I think it's the greatest golf tournament that's ever been played. I mean, not the Masters itself. I mean, that's fantastic. But I mean, the 86 Masters worth. You couldn't have wrote the script any better than what happened. Were you aware because you're right in there, you finished T11. Were you aware of what was going on with Jack's push that year? And, you know, what sort of memories do you have of that entire week as your first Masters? And then to see what transpired that week was pretty amazing, and also, you know, playing really well as you did.
Yeah, there was, you know, Masters is one of those weeks where you just totally enjoy the whole week. The practice rounds are even fun, unlike, you know, a lot of tournaments on tour where they take, you know, forever to play. But that week was just, you enjoy the whole week. I was coming off a win at the Hope, got to play 9 holes with Arnold Palmer on Tuesday, just the two of us. He invited me to come out, and he really helped me a lot, you know, showing me lines on the golf course, and that helped. That gave me confidence. And then I played well for 3 days, and I was in the next to last group on Sunday playing with Bernhard Langer. And Jack was, I think he was like 6 back or so, really wasn't a contender right then. But I think about the time we got to the 10th hole, his name came up on the leaderboard, probably about when he was finished 13 or so. And then being on the golf course, you could hear, you know, you could hear the eagle on 15. You pretty much knew that was an eagle from Jack. You could tell, you know, where you were on the golf course. And then 16, and then, you know, being able to watch it a couple months later was just, then you really got to see, you know, what a great tournament that was, and what he was able to do at age 45.
Is it hard to stay focused in your own game when that kind of circus is going on?
Yeah, a little bit.
I would have to imagine, yeah.
I was a little bit out of contention. I didn't have a good front nine. Something about my right knee, I think, started kicking in on the first tee there. It started shimmying, and I'm like, what is my knee doing here? I'm trying to win the tournament. But, you know, I was trying to at least keep it together, get in the top 24 to get invited back the next year, try to make birdies to possibly get back in where you'd have a chance with 6 or 8 holes to go. But it was kind of anticlimactic after about 9 holes or so, but I kind of hung in there and shot a couple under on the back and finished up pretty good.
And part of history, right? I mean, you're out there on the day that, you know, generations will be talking about what happened at the 86 Masters. I think it's just fantastic. The best golf tournament, the best back nine you'll ever see in your life that year. So it's cool you were a part of
it.
Oh,
yeah.
Speaking of legends, you, like I said, you got to play with Mr. Palmer that week, but also after you win the Bob Hope Chrysler Classic, I'm assuming you get to meet and spend some time with Mr. Hope. What was that experience like to win his tournament from, you know, meeting a legend, and any interesting stories from that?
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, the first round, I get to the tee there at the Bob Hope, and I couldn't even find the tee markers. There were reporters and cameramen and people and amateurs and caddies. I couldn't even find where the tee marker was, so I had to kind of walk around a little bit, and I met President Ford and Tip O'Neill, and then, you know, introduced myself to Mr. Hope, and we just had a great day. We played, I think I shot around even or 1 under par. It wasn't a really good round there, but President Ford invited me to play in his tournament, the Jerry Ford Invitational in Vail, which kind of introduced me to the mountains out there in Colorado, and ended up getting to win that tournament about three times up there, and really enjoyed, you know, being in Colorado in the summertime. And hopefully I'll end up out there one day. I almost made a move in the last month or so to kind of head out that way, but still looking for some opportunities out that way. But it was a great day.
Yeah. What's it like to play golf with a president? Are you nervous, or do you just absorb what that day is? Because, like, what a cool experience that has to be to actually spend time with an American president.
Yeah, and I was a big fan of his too. He was a really good athlete. He got a lot of credit for not being a great golfer, but he was always playing in front of big crowds, so that's why he had targets out there once in a while. So he was a good athlete, football player. I think I worked with him a little bit on the golf course that day. I tried to give everybody a few little tips, but it's definitely an honor to be able to, play with the president and Bob Hope. I actually asked Bob for a joke that, I said, "Bob, tell me one I've never heard." And I'll tell it to you sometime. It's kind of a long joke, but it's a great joke, clean joke, and really funny. But, I'll tell it to you one day.
Second tour win, 1989. You got Azinger by 7 shots at the Texas Open. Does that second victory sort of validate the first one? And is that kind of in the eyes of your peers in the PGA Tour sort of take you to the next level?
Yeah, a little bit. It was the end of the year. I had my card kept and kind of went into Texas not really playing that well. I was working with Gary McCord throughout that year, who was teaching the Mac O'Grady method, which is, a little narrower stance, kind of roll it back a little closer to your body. But it started to kind of gel a little bit that week. And I got off to one of those starts a little bit like the tour school, 65, 64, 65, had a 2-stroke lead going into the last day, and then shot the low round 64 on Sunday and had a pretty easy win. But then the next couple of weeks were great. I got to finish second in Disney the next week and then fifth at the tour, championship, and then was the player of the month that month. So that was, I'd say that's probably the favorite month on tour that I had out there, is to be able to, put together 3 top fives there in 3 weeks in a row. And then the season ended. I had to kind of wait for January to get around.
And then, playing golf in the 80s, I think there's, I'm just paraphrasing here, but there's like a nostalgia about it, right? Where I think people think like Sansa belt pants, mustaches, no one worked out. It wasn't as like serious as like, let me rephrase it. It doesn't appear to be as serious as it is like today with guys working out constantly, eating perfect. That generation, I kind of have like this spot in my heart of, Roger Maltby at the bar after a round, having a good time and relaxing that way versus like, going and pressing weights. And my question is there truth to that? Was it more chill? Was it more easygoing? Or were you guys working as hard as they do today? Just there were things that were just different?
No, we didn't work as hard as they do today. We didn't swing the club as well as they do today. We might have dressed better than they do today because we had – a lot more individuality, I think, on our costumes, I'll call them. You remember those pants Roger had on for that one win? I mean, I've never seen pants like that on a guy that's won a golf tournament.
Plaid or something, like some really crazy plaid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they were fantastic. And we, we wore all kind of different kinds of special golf shoes and, light wool pants. I think, today the guys are, you got to have a pair of white pants if you're going to play the tour these days. I know that.
Yeah, and it just seems, obviously the swings look much more alike now than they did back then. There was, you could tell the guys from, that's his swing. Ed Fiore, you brought him up. I mean, no one else swung on tour like Ed Fiore, right?
And the grip.
The grip. We had more characters, right? And that's why I think there's this nostalgia of the characters that were on the tour in the 80s and sort of the lifestyle that it was, with like Maltby losing the check at a bar after winning the 40. I mean, like, that's not going to happen today, right? Like, they're going to go to the private jet, fly back with their, their entourage, their group, their team, and Maltby's like, I'm assuming he's like, where's the nearest bar? Let's have a good time. Which, like, I think that's how most people want to golf, right? Like you.
We were playing for a lot less money back then, so it wasn't as serious. It's kind of like the Champions Tour now. You're out there. You're not playing for as much money. There's no cut in most of the tournaments. Yeah, there were a lot of great characters back then on tour, a lot of different swings. But I tell you that I think the tour is as healthy now with the guys that are playing. I think there's fantastic young guys out there playing the tour. Ricky Fowler, Brooks Koepka, Keegan just won. You know, Tony Finau. There's just some great personalities. Dustin Johnson, Justin Thomas. They're, you know, they're tight. They kind of hang out together. They joke with each other, take trips. So I think the personalities on tour right now are great. It's fun to watch, and it's in a real good spot.
So you're still a fan of the game? You'll watch the PGA Tour if it's on, or you still follow it a little bit, even though you're a professional yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, I especially like, you know, the tournaments that I enjoy to play. You know, of course, the majors, but I always loved Riviera. Muirfield Village was one of my favorite weeks on tour. Love that golf course. And Hilton Head was always good. But, you know, I like to watch, I watch a lot of the lady majors too, to see, you know, see how they're closing out tournaments. And I'm still as big a fan now of golf as ever. And it's really cool to watch some of the talented players, because they've really taken it to another level. Guys, you know, Justin Thomas, the way they hit it, and Ricky Fowler, they just, they're better golfers now than, you know, it's just, you know, the development of the game, I guess, in every sport, the players are getting better, and, you know, they're awful good right now.
Did you play a lot of the Tuesday money games when you were on the PGA Tour to keep yourself sharp? And if so, is there some great gambling stories that you guys had back in the day?
Nah, I didn't really gamble a lot on Tuesdays. We played, you know, little skins games, birdie skins. When we were home, we would gamble a little bit, but not too much on Tuesdays, like, you know, like Phil might have out there on tour.
Yeah, some guys I've talked to you say they do to keep it, you know, to keep themselves competitively sharp on Tuesday, and some guys just want to practice. So I always think it's an interesting question to ask of, you know, what was your normal routine? Did you use that as a practice day, or is that a day you wanted some competitive action?
It was more fun to have a little action, for sure, because, you know, you're out there for 4.5 hours. It's kind of boring just hitting 10 or 15 putts, you know, on certain greens. It was more fun to have a little action, especially if you played the course, you know, a couple years in the tournament and you kind of knew where the pins were going to be. It was always more fun to have a little action during the round.
You know, you watch the modern game versus what it was in the 80s and 90s. And I agree with the athletes are great and they're taking it to the next level. But do you think the modern game has a little bit of loss of artistry to it, in the sense that the ball doesn't curve as much? It's maybe not as pretty, in the sense that now you can really just hit it 350 off the tee and then kind of wedge it on. Is there parts of your era that you think, by maybe bringing the ball back or making it spin a little bit more, would make golf at the professional level a little bit more interesting than what it's, you know, currently is? Or do you kind of like the direction of, you know, where it's going?
I think the ball has gotten too long. I don't know if you can really dial it back at this point. It seems like the golf manufacturers are always just a little bit a step ahead of the USGA in their testing versus the USGA testing. So whether it's the drivers, the coalition, or the face diameters, the layer on the golf ball, they're always just a little bit ahead. But I think it would be helpful to dial the ball back a little bit. I mean, it used to be an advantage when you could hit a 275, like a Tom Pertzer could hit a 275, 278, and your average distance would be 255 or 260. You could really separate yourself a little bit from the other players. But now, you know, everybody seems to hit at 310 or 320. So there's, you know, you get a 480 par four and it's driver 9 iron for a lot of the guys. So it's a different game. You're not really hitting 4 irons or 3 irons into par fours very often, or even par fives for that matter.
Would you be okay with two sets of rules, one for us and one for golf at the top level?
I always thought the tour could do a little bit better job kind of maintaining, you know, a few of rules on our own and not really relying on the USGA and the RGA for everything that, you know, that we have to play by, that you, there could be little tweaks in there, and the golf ball would certainly be one of them, because most players, you know, they want to hit it as far as they can. $50 a dozen for balls, that's fine, you know, if you can get it out there another 10 or 12 yards. But I think, you know, I think we could, that's something I'm sure they're looking at. It might be a little bit complicated, because then guys are, you know, they're getting paid by their manufacturers. And if you go to a standardized ball, that kind of gets into that a little bit. But I think it would make the game a little more interesting if it was dialed back, you know, 5%, 10% on the ball, on the speed of the ball.
I was also looking at your record in the majors when I was, you know, knew this was coming up, and you played really well in the Open Championship, which I, my personal thought is it's the greatest championship in the world. My question is, what did playing in the Open bring out in you, or why do you think you played so well in that championship?
Well, I'd been living in Florida for a long time, so it's kind of, it was always weird to be packing sweaters in July, getting ready to head to a golf tournament. I think it kind of brought out some enthusiasm for me to travel. I like to travel a lot. I would go to Australia and Japan and Europe, try to play in as many tournaments as I could. So I really look forward to going over there. A lot of times I would play the Scottish Open the week before to kind of get used to the time change. It takes, you know, 4 or 5 days to really settle down when you're flying east like that. So I'd get over and play Scotland, and I just enjoyed meeting, you know, a lot of the Scots over there. They really revere the game, and I just had a great time spending, you know, a lot of time in the evening, little pubs, and talking to a lot of the fans over there throughout the week. And somehow I played well in certain tournaments. I'm not sure why, really, but might have been that I was just really enthusiastic about having a good tournament over there. But I love the courses. Yeah, I love St. Andrews, Muirfield. Turnberry was first year I played, but the courses were tough. The weather was tough. You know, really changed from hour to hour over there. But man, I ended up getting some really nice sweaters over there over the years. Though manufacturers would give you some really nice cashmere sweaters, and then it would look like you'd be on TV the next day too. You'd open the locker and here's another just beautiful cashmere sweater, and I still have some from 20 some years ago. They're still really nice.
And then if you put that with the Maltby pants and some good looking shoes, right? That's how a tour player should dress, right? That's the old school way.
That's it.
Well, and did you enjoy the creativity that those golf courses required? Like when you're talking about how the weather can change from 1 hour to 1 hour, the golf course can change so much from day to day. Was that a challenge or a part of it that you really embraced and enjoyed?
You know, it wasn't as enjoyable when you were out there on the course and you had a light rain coming down, you know, 20 mile an hour winds and nobody shooting under par. It was a battle to be out there and to keep, you know, grinding and trying to make pars. But, you know, you knew the scores were relative that day, so you kind of had to have an idea what was going to be a decent score. But it was, you know, it was fun to play a lot of different shots. You'd hit a lot of bump and runs around the greens. A lot of times you could hit your 3-iron 250 yards downwind, you know, with a hard surface there. So it really broadened your kind of experience and knowledge of the game on different shots, and I enjoyed that part of it.
I'm going to throw some names out there of guys that are associated with your era of the 80s and the 90s, and if you can just give me your quick thoughts on each one of them, just sort of rapid fire them off and what kind of comes to mind. So the guy you clipped by 7, Paul Azinger.
Singer, best bunker player ever. Was always happy to help guys too. Was always helping guys in the bunker. Great Ryder Cup competitor, super guy too. Great pairing to play with Paul. And you know, if he would have played more tournaments and maybe extended his career a little bit, he probably could have won 4 or 5 majors. Just a great ball striker and fun to be with on the golf course.
Hal Sutton.
Hal has actually talked about coming back now. He's been teaching for a year or so. I think he's going to come back and play the Champions Tour next year, which will be interesting. Once again, started the tour the year before me and probably was as good an iron player as I saw on tour. just could, you know, you could go out on a windy day in Texas and he would just shoot the easiest 70 that you'd ever see, because of just driving it in the fairway and hitting, you know, phenomenal iron shots all day. Really solid.
Lanny Watkins.
Lanny was pound for pound. He's like Ricky Fowler as far as a competitor. You know, he would get that win in his sights and just take it from there, you know, with nine holes to go. He would fire at every pin. It didn't matter if he had four iron or three wood. Lanny was going to, you know, take it where he wanted it to go. And I had a good little battle with him one week in Hartford, coming down the stretch. It was him and I going for the win. And as usual, he came out on top, but I ended up talking to him after that and told him he was kind of one of my little idols when I was about 16 or so. I liked the way he played the game and went about competing. And I ended up telling him he was, you know, one of my favorites, and that was a lot of fun. And it was a good time up there in Hartford that week.
Payne Stewart.
Payne was just a beautiful swing. Probably the most elegant swing on tour. Great chipper, putter, and he was as good a pairing too as you could play with. He was just out there having a great time. A little bit like Fuzzy, that, you know, you couldn't get nervous when you were with Payne because he would kind of needle you a little bit and just have, you know, have fun on the golf course. And you know, just a tragedy that we lost him early, but you know, just a great ambassador of the game. And yeah, you know, he was a good friend.
Todd Watson.
Tom is, man, he's just been great for 45 years or so. Could have been one of the greatest sporting achievements ever there to win the British Open there when Stuart Sink won. Great open player, probably the best modern era open player. Fun, never, hardly ever left putt short. When I'd play with him, he was, you know, he would hit putts like Ricky Fowler. There, if it misses, it's going 3 feet by. Nice long swing. That's the kind of swing that you could use, you know, if you get to be 50, is watch the way he takes it back and rotates his left wrist and opens the club face. That's longevity when you can get the backswing where he does. That I've tried to emulate his swing sometimes when I try to get a longer backswing.
And my last one here, Greg Norman.
Yeah, the Shark was as exciting as anybody on the golf course. I played a lot with him in the mid-80s when he came over. We were in the same category for pairings on Thursdays and Fridays, so must have played 12 or 16 times there the first couple years. Kind of reminded me of Jack Nicklaus, the way he would drive the ball. He was the best driver on tour, hit towering tee shots, could, you know, take a tough golf course and shoot 63 or 64 in a heartbeat. Two of the greatest rounds he shot. I think he shot 63 with me one day at Bay Hill. And then he shot that second round at Turnberry, which was really good. I think 63 or 64 in a really windy day. He ended up winning that British Open, but he was really exciting to be with on the golf course, and was one of those guys that really, I think, took tour and the TV to another level. You know, it was Arnold, Jack, Greg Norman, Tiger. He was one of those guys that that really helped, you know, grow the game with the TV audience in the U.S.
Got just a few more here for you. They're sort of, once again, sort of quick thoughts that come to your mind on it. We'll let you get back to the golf course practicing here. But we've talked about some, you know, the people that you met, President of the United States, Arnold Palmer, Bob Hope. Because of the game of golf and you being around it, being a professional, is there any other really interesting people you've gotten to meet and that you've gotten to meet because you're in the game of golf that come to mind?
Well, yeah, I mean, the cool thing about golf is there's so many interesting people that play the game, all walks of life, but there's just been so many people that, you know, that had an impact with me as far as getting better at golf. And it would, you know, start with my parents and then college coach, Raleigh Rourke. And then on the tour, you know, I had friends. Larry Rinker was always helpful on tour. He was always kind of getting lessons and being able to help kind of tweak me on tour a little bit instead of me getting a lot of lessons. He's always been helpful, and he's a great instructor right now. He's he's probably, you know, my best friend on tour and helped me as much as anybody. But Gary McCord was a big help. Phil Ritson, I worked with him for 4 or 5 years. He just passed away a year and a half ago, but he was a big help. And you know, the game is full of people out there that, you know, are pretty generous with their time, and it's makes kind of pass some of your information forward. And it's kind of at that stage guys my age are at now where we're trying to, you know, help some of the younger players and get a little better and still hopefully shoot a few 68s, you know, before we're all done.
What's the best two or three golf courses architecturally you have played around the world, and what makes those courses so special?
I think my favorite course is Pacific Dunes out there at Bandon Dunes. Got to play there a couple times. I think it's just the nature, you know, the hills and the gorse, windswept, you know, right on the Pacific Ocean. Love that. Of course, Pebble Beach is right there. I love Royal Melbourne. Melbourne's a great golf course. Over in Europe, I like St. Andrews. It's kind of subtle, but, you know, you learn something new every time you play there. And, of course, Muirfield Village. That was really one of my great stops on tour. I spend as much time during the day there as I could practicing and hanging out in the clubhouse. It was real, real fun to be.
Well, my last one here for you, I'm going to have you put your analyst hat on. The Ryder Cup's coming up. Both teams look pretty stacked to me. What is your thoughts on that event of which team do you like? And, you know, the captain's picks are in. Sort of, if you had to pick one side or the other, who do you like and why?
Well, I think I'm going to be objective, and I'm still going to go with the U.S. because, like you say, that team is stacked. And I love the picks, the four picks, Tony Finau, Tiger, Phil. I mean, those guys are playing great. They're coming off, you know, some big tournaments here. The advantage with the Europeans is they're going to be over there kind of resting for a week or two. Accustomed to that, they're going to be on their home turf, home fans. I always thought our team would do a little better if we went over, you know, 5 or 6 days before the event, maybe had some of those games where you're playing, you know, $100, $500, you play two against two, do some alternate shots, experiment with the ball a little bit, get over there, build a little team camaraderie and adjust to the time zone. So, you know, if they're able to get over there and not have to go to too many parties and things, I think the U.S. is going to be pretty tough this year.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I greatly appreciate it. Good luck the rest of the year with the Champions Tour, and we'll keep watching how you're doing out there. And like I said, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Sure thing. I had a great time talking to you, Jason.